Well, recently we completed a fairly lengthy series on the hard sayings of Jesus, so it doesn't take too much knowledge of the Bible to figure out, wow, that was a New Testament series. So I want to switch gears and move us to the Old Testament in our Sunday morning services for a while, and we're going to be looking at a series on the life of Saul. Some time ago, I brought a series on the life of David. And it's interesting, when you think about Saul, you might sort of scratch your head for a moment and say, really, a series on the life of Saul? And probably if you did that, the reason that you would do that is because Saul is a rather tragic character in Scripture. And so we think of all the negativity that we know about surrounding the life of Saul. And I guess maybe it's fair to say that ordinarily when we do a series on someone's life, we sort of pick someone that we deem to be a positive example or maybe even a hero. And I doubt anybody here this morning wants to call Saul his hero. But sometimes negative example is a very, very powerful teacher. Sometimes you can really learn if your heart is open by looking at the mistakes either that you make or others make. Some of those mistakes are sufficient that you say, I don't want to go there under any circumstances. And so it really can be very powerful. I hope it will be an encouragement as all of this develops for us. There's a simple way that we can look at the life of Saul. If you were going to take what's in the Bible and break it down, we might say that in the very beginning of Saul's life, in chapters 9 through 12, there is early promise. Saul had promise. He really did. So there's early promise that we are going to be kind of overall in that sense as we look at these chapters. That'll sort of be what we're noticing, the early promise. Now, however, as you get into the large center section, which we'll call chapter 13 through chapter 27 in 1 Samuel, that's where we're going to be spending time looking at fatal flaws. And if fatal sounds like a strong word to you, it is, but they were. And finally, when we get to the end in chapter 28, 29, 30, and 31, we'll be looking at, unfortunately, a tragic ending. We will be saying to ourselves, I don't want to go there. That can be powerful. This morning, I want to bring you a message that I've entitled, Desiring God's Best. Do you desire God's best? You may think you do, but this morning you're going to see an instance where a lot of people did not. And some of the repercussions of that we'll look at. Desiring God's best. I'm going to ask us to look at chapter 9 this morning in three scenes. And so as we develop this morning, the first thing I want us to consider is pent-up desire, which is why I asked that the scripture reading be changed from the actual chapter that we're looking at, which is chapter number 9, and read chapter 8 as background material, because you really can't understand what's going on unless you realize that the background of this pent-up desire, what exactly it is, and hear some of that. What was this pent-up desire? Well, Israel desired a king. Think about that for a moment. Israel desired a king. Were they wrong to desire a king? Yes and no. But let's look at the no part for a moment. In and of itself, there was nothing wrong with Israel desiring a king. In fact, if you were to go back into the Old Testament, and I'll give you the reference of the verse if you want to look for it. I'm not going to take the time to look. But for example, you could go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, and if you were to look there, verse 14, you would find that God is talking to them there in that book as if he certainly expected that one day they would have a king, because one of the things he says to them there, when you get ready to have a king, like the nations around you, don't set a man to be king who's not a brother. In other words, he should not be a foreigner, he should not be a stranger, he should be a brother, he should be an Israelite, he should be a man of faith. That, of course, assumes that they would have the king, and there's nothing in God's wording of any of that we would take to be an indication that something was wrong. But I'll tell you what really is the cincher or clincher, if you wish, on this. This is when we begin to understand something that was actually in the final stanza of that song that we had in the opening of Sunday school this morning. That praise him, Jesus, our blessed Redeemer. I don't know if you caught this, because sometimes we sing these words and maybe we don't really pay much attention to what we're singing, but you get to that last stanza, and one of the lines in that says, crown him prophet and priest and king. Remember that, if you were here and heard that? Or, if you didn't hear that or sing that this morning, it reminds us of something, doesn't it? It reminds us that there were three offices in the Old Testament that were indeed ordained by God: prophet, priest, and king. And they were all typical. They all portrayed an aspect of Messiah. Jesus, of course, is the ultimate fulfillment of the office of prophet. He's the ultimate fulfillment because when you come to the book of Hebrews, he's our great high priest. See, the ultimate fulfillment of the role of priest, and he is certainly the ultimate fulfillment of king. He is the King of Kings. So, for example, and you don't really have to turn because I think what I'm telling you is not exactly brand new to you, but it is good to have this background. 2 Samuel chapter 7, which in the second book of Samuel, that second chapter is where we find the record of the Davidic covenant. So when David assumed the throne, and I just want to read one verse out of this because this will help us to understand something. It says, and thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. Now, it's sort of to anticipate something, but he says, thy house. And David was of the house of Judah. Saul was of the house of Benjamin. But when we read this verse, we find out that obviously God intended to bring Messiah to Israel through the house of David and through the line of David, and that kingdom would endure forever. Ultimately, that can only be fulfilled by Messiah. So obviously God intended that one day they would have a king. The office of king would be something of a typical thing. If anything, looking at the different men who were king, there were some very good examples, but there were a whole lot of ones that weren't. Makes you really think about what it would be to have someone ruling and reigning who makes all the right decisions all the time. I can assure you we don't have that today. It's kind of sad, actually. But in any event, they were not wrong for wanting a king. Not necessarily, but there was a yes part to this. And you sort of get wise to the fact that there was something not exactly right in this. And in chapter 8, if you would look back there for just a moment, look at verse number 6. It says, the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. Well, right away, there's your tip. If something doesn't set right about this asking for a king with Samuel, and he takes it to the Lord, and it's then confirmed when you look at the very next verse. The Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Well, you don't need much more than that to figure out that Samuel didn't quite feel this set right. The man of God was upset by this request. And then when he confers with God about it, God says, well, don't take it personally. You know, that's hard to do sometimes. Don't take it personally. Easier for somebody to tell you that than for you to obey that. But what God was telling him, don't take it personally, because ultimately it's not you they've rejected. Because Samuel was a prophet and a judge. Ultimately, it's not you they've rejected. It's me they've rejected. It's me they're tired of. It's me they don't want, really. So it was confirmed very, very clearly, I think, from all of this. Something about this is not right. So what is it that's not right? And I think that we can point out a couple of things this morning as we look at this first section in the story this morning. First of all, if we look at this and think about their motive was not right in this. They were dishonest. We'll look at what that motive is in a moment, but I think for now, it's enough for us just to say this. They were dishonest. And you say to yourself, well, how were they dishonest? Preacher, where are you coming from? Where do you get that? They were dishonest. Have you ever had anybody come to you and They had something on their mind, but they didn't just come and spit it out and really say what it was. And they kind of, well, they circumlocuted the polar veracity. You know what that means? They beat around the bush. They didn't really tell you. They just kind of fudged around. So you can get yourself in trouble that way sometimes. It's better just to be straightforward, although be respectful and be polite. I remember a visit I went on one evening, and I didn't really think we were doing this. We honestly went there because we had some notion that there was some concern on the part of the people, though they hadn't really said it what it was. And so I think I was with Brother Jack, but we go in here, and we're talking to these people, husband and wife, and we just tried to ask a few simple questions without them being leading questions. But it didn't take very long for the man to say, "It seems like you're here on a fishing expedition." Oh, whoa. Okay. I guess there are some concerns they have to come up with that one. But why do I say they were dishonest? Well, look at verse number 5. It says here, "And said unto him, Behold, thou art old." Wonderful tact. "And thy sons walk not in thy way." So what they gave as the first off upfront reason why they wanted a king was, "Your sons aren't following in your footsteps." Well, I don't think that was any news flash to Samuel. His sons weren't following in his footsteps. And of course, that's a sad thing, but he knew that. That wasn't anything particularly new to him. And that's what the first four verses of the chapters are is about. Verse number 3 says, "His sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment." That's not good. They weren't qualified to follow their father as leader. But Samuel knew that, and God knew that, and I don't think God was going to put them in either. But they gave that. See, that's plausible. Someone comes to you with something that's plausible, but it's really not what is in their mind. It's really kind of a way to say, "Well, let me give you something." It's like I've heard people before who say, if once in a while it happens, and someone stops coming or something, and you go and you visit them, and they say, well, we weren't fed. We want to go someplace where we can be fed. And I always just smile when I hear that, because I know that's the biggest load of bull I've ever heard in my life. So what exactly was going on here? Well, it sort of slips out. It sort of slips out quietly at first, but it's confirmed later in the chapter. And this would be the second idea where I think we can figure out they were not honest. But the second idea is, I'm going to phrase it negatively because I think it's a little easier for us to identify with it if I do it that way. They were tired of being different. Where do we see that in this? Well, at the end of verse number 5, "Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." And then if we look over, though, later in the chapter, verse 19 says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." They got tired of being different. All the nations around them had kings. Anything wrong with that? Not necessarily. And as we've already noted, one day God did intend for them to have a king. But right now, what motivates this isn't good, because it's a discomfort and a tiring of being different. Well, can you identify with that? Because I sure can. And I don't want you to think I'm preaching down to you this morning. I think every one of us feels this. Because you know something? That's kind of written into the job description of a Christian. Because Romans 12:2 says, "And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." So you're a teenager and you go to school, and the kids kind of notice that you're a little different because you don't do certain things and you don't talk a certain way. And, you know, there are some Christians that are kind of like Israel in this instance. They just get tired of being different, so they just kind of change and they just adapt to whatever set of circumstances they're in. And they come to church, they don't talk that way, but they go to school and they sort of change, because it just gets old sometimes being different. It is hard to be different. It's hard to be different when you're the only one at work. And it's break time, so you go to the break room, and all they want to do is tell dirty jokes. And they know they do that. They're trying to get to you, so you kind of maybe have a way you... Or they talk about you, and, oh, there goes the holy roller. Or they come up to you and say, hey, preach! You know, it's not the most fun thing in the world, and the devil tends to use that to discourage us and take the wind out of our sails, and it's all a device, you know. It's all a device to wear you down to the point that you'll sort of stop trying to not conform, and you'll sort of give way to the pressure to conform. You know, that's exactly what the world always tries to do. Did you know that? Just as it's in the job description of a Christian not to conform, it's in the job description of the world to pressure you, and not just Christians, really, it's anyone. That's what's the problem in our country today. Did you know that? You have an administration and a media that want to have you and me conform to how they think. Sorry. Well, we do live in America. There is freedom of speech. There is freedom of the press. So those folks are more than welcome to have their point of view. But to me, what's the most hypocritical aspect of that crowd is they're generous until it comes to someone who disagrees with them. And then they're mean and nasty and defaming. And it happens all the time. It happens all the time. All you have to do is read the news to see how it happens. Why is that? They want to pressure you into their little cookie cutter approach. And it, you know, it's just kind of wears you down after a while. That Romans passage sort of has the key to it. You have to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You're not going to hold up under that kind of pressure if you're not constantly seeking those opportunities that God provides to be renewed in the spirit of your mind. If you're not reading your Bible, if you're not fellowshipping with Christian people, that's going to get to you after a while. And you probably will compromise. And that's what it was with Israel. I mean, you can imagine if someone came to Israel and came to what was as close to a center of government as they had at that point and said, well, who's your king? Oh, we don't have a king. Oh, well, how do you run the country? Well, God raises up judges and prophets and, oh, yeah, a little strange. That's what the people wanted. Now, they gave us the reason to fight our battles. If you look back in the past history of Israel, they didn't have any problem finding somebody to fight their battles when God was with them, did they? All through the period of the judges, they didn't have any problem finding someone who could fight their battles, did they? As long as they were walking with the Lord, and when the Lord sought to raise up someone to bring deliverance to them, they cleaned the clocks of their enemies. There was no problem. God had never forsaken them. But it was a period of time in which they didn't have a king, but God had always been faithful to them. So, no wonder Samuel is just a bit disquieted, because he actually represented that. He was sort of the end of that in actuality, because Saul came next. And so, no wonder it disturbed him. And the third thing that we see, that just, you can tell why Samuel's spirit is disquieted, you can tell why he's displeased, you can understand why this is so, because not only were they dishonest when they came to him, and I think he saw through it, and not only were they motivated instead by a tiredness of being tired of being different, which isn't good. In the third place, it was quite apparent that they weren't willing to wait for God to do it. They weren't willing to wait for God's time. You know, that is hard, waiting on God's time. I don't wait well, do you? I mean, wait's hard. Any way you spell it, W-A-I-T-W-E-I-G-H-T, any way you spell it. Not easy to deal with, is it? Any way you spell it. Did God intend for them to have a king? Obviously, he intended for them to have a king. And their willingness to jump the gun, their unwillingness to wait on God's time, they got a king all right, But sometimes what we think we have to have so badly turns out to be the very thing in the end that we wish we'd never even talked about. We wish we'd never gone there. And so that happens in this particular case, and this is the reason that Samuel was disquieted, and these are some of the reasons why this really wasn't a good thing. So in the first phase of our story, as we look at this pent-up desire, nothing really wrong with the desire, but you can see where there are problems. All right, let's transition to scene number two, and we'll call this initial joy. So everything seemed to turn out. Maybe all the things that Samuel said about the warnings and all these things that we read in chapter 8, maybe it really didn't, it wasn't going to happen. And if you want a summary verse, turn over just to chapter 11 for a moment and look at the last verse, if I can get the pages apart. Here we go. Look at the last verse. And all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. And there they sacrificed sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel, what's that say? Rejoiced greatly. And the whole thing that I want you to see here is, see, in the early stages, it looked like everything was just going to be peachy. It looked like maybe all those forebodings, all those things that Samuel was worried about, and all those things that he protested to them about, this is going to be the nature of the king, all of that, those things really weren't going to happen. Well, there are some reasons why it worked out this way. And I think maybe the thing to say up front is, you know, God is not cruel. And they insisted on a king, and so God said, all right, I'll give you a king. And I really believe that this is a true statement. I think God gave them the best he had at the time. Why would I say that? Well, there's at least two things you can see why there was this early joy. Not only had they had this pent-up desire, but Saul was physically impressive. Now, you don't necessarily have to have that as a qualification of being a good leader. But, you know, if you're just like if you're facing three guys in a dark alley, and each one of them is 6'3", and you're about 5'7", I don't think they're necessarily going to look at you and be impressed and leave you alone. The 5'7 guy might take them all out. It might work out that way. But physically impressive is often something that commands our attention. And it was true of Saul. Look at chapter 9 where we opened our reading this morning. And verse number 2, we see it there. And he, that is Kish, had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and a goodly. And look at this. There was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. So when it says he was goodly and then says among the children of Israel there was not one goodlier, what's that mean? Well, it means handsome. He had physical appeal. He was a nice looking man. And not to acquaint that with being kind of a pretty boy, because when you read the next part of it, it says this of him. It says, from his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. In other words, he was essentially without equal in Israel. This is why I say to you, God gave them the best that he could come up with at the time. You know, I don't know why it is, other than these pages don't want to turn. But anyway, it's true. And actually, I was looking for a verse where that is later confirmed, and I seem to have misplaced that verse. So let me check here real quick, because I think maybe this would be good for us to see. Okay, it was right where I was looking for it. Verse 24 of chapter 10. See, and Samuel said to all the people, see ye him whom the Lord hath chosen, that there is none like him among all the people. So he was impressive. And if you're going to have a leader, it's nice to have one who's impressive, isn't it? I mean, I think we would feel that way, really. I mean, a man is elected president, you like to feel he's impressive. You like to feel like he's going to command respect on the world scene. And, you know, he should be impressive. You hope, at least, he'll be impressive in terms of his experience and credentials. You hope he'll be impressive in terms of being a leader. There's a lot of things I think we aspire for in a president. And this is perfectly natural. This is perfectly normal. And Saul was impressive. He was a good-looking man, but he was tall, and he was essentially without equal. And when they looked at him, they went, this guy's got what it takes. Well, he had the outward appearance, maybe. But you know, man looks on the outward appearance. God looks on the heart. But I'll tell you something else. Second thought here. He had popular appeal. And you notice that a skillful politician will always try to accomplish this. To identify with people. To sort of make them feel like he's one of them. Or to portray characteristics just in the way he dresses or just in his appearance that people identify with. Our current state representative has such a sign as you come into Huntington from east, right before or right about the time you get to the Dairy Queen, you can look at it. You know who our state representative is? You know, we're getting ready to have a primary election. Do you know who our state representative is? Tell me his name. Okay. Well, look at the sign. You'll see what I'm talking about. Politicians understand this. They understand what it is to have popular appeal. And why do I say this? Well, I think that Saul was this type of a person. When we first meet Saul, it's not that he's kind of a, I'll use an expression that I learned the other day from Cindy Lane, he wasn't hotsy-totsy. He's just sort of a natural guy. Verse number 3, what's he doing? It says the asses of Kish, his father, or his Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to Saul, his son, take now one of the servants with thee and arise and go seek the asses. Well, it's not like he's too good to just kind of identify, take a servant and go do this kind of thing. But particularly when you get to later in the chapter, you see this. And when Saul, or when Samuel says to him about being king, look at verse 21 of chapter 9. Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite? Well, you have to kind of remember the history here, because what happened in the period of the judges to the tribe of Benjamin? Well, they were just nearly wiped out, remember, because they had the problems occurred and the Israelites went down there and tried to deal with them, and they decided they were going to fight rather than deal with the moral problem and deal with the issues that were there. They decided they were going to fight. And you remember this right towards the end of the book of Judges. So, you know, it ended up that we're like 600 of them left, the men, 600 of the men left. And they were really just wiped out. So when he says this, he says, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, smallest? And my family, the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Wherefore then speakest thou so to me? So, in other words, he's not trying to do this. This is dead sincere. This is not just a politician with a sign trying to say something and make you think, hey, I'm one of you. I'm a good old boy. This is dead honest. He's basically just saying, you know, I'm one of the people. You're talking about royalty. You're talking about being the king. And I don't come from some impressive house, from some impressive family, I'm from the smallest tribe, and my father's not really known. But the reason that this ended up giving him this popular appeal, because what it said to people was, he's a populist. He's one of us. And so they liked him. They liked him, and they thought that maybe everything was going to work out okay. And right now I've got to give you quickly the spiritual lesson of this, that, you know, and this is a trap the devil knows. that sometimes when we get off track, just like the children of Israel got off track because they couldn't wait for God's time, and they insisted on having something that, though not wrong in itself, in this particular instance, really was not God's will. But in the beginning, it seemed like everything was great, and it seemed like the preacher just gave all those warnings and tried to talk to me, and it's all just never happened. I knew he didn't know what he was talking about. See, I walk this road. I see this. And I understand even in my own life, this kind of thing can happen. And so what it is the point of it all is that in the beginning of a decision like that, we don't necessarily see God's wisdom vindicated, nor do we necessarily see all of the consequences of the sin involved in the wrong decision. Oh, you really think the devil's going to come up to you and just advertise what it's really going to be 10 years from now? So we get all caught up in the euphoria of the thing. We've just got to have it. And I think maybe an example of how this can sometimes happen is sometimes, you know, a guy or a gal just sees a guy or a gal. I'm trying to get the right one with the right one. And they just kind of become taken. And the word that we use for that sometimes is infatuated. And they begin spending time with this person. One thing leads to another, and they just really decide, oh, I got to have this person. This has got to be my boyfriend. This has got to be my girlfriend. Maybe I'll even marry this person. And things keep on developing. And then what happens is sometimes there's people around that just kind of, you know, and they're not unkind. They're not rude, but they just kind of, you know, and maybe some of them that are close enough to you that they feel that they can do this, maybe express a concern. You sure this is the right kind of person? You sure that, you know, they're able to sense that maybe this is not a good kind of person? But you got to have it. You just get caught all up in it. And there's that euphoria. And you don't really think about 10 years down the road, 5 years down the road, 15 years down the road. You know, I've seen a ton of those things, and you probably have too. It makes a good example to use where the guy knew how to talk just the right kind of language, and he talked about church, and he talked about Sunday school, and he talked about a Christian home for the kids and all that kind of stuff. And those were the kinds of things that you as a young lady were worried about. So you kind of, you know, just minced around a little bit, put that out there a little bit. And he knew exactly how to abate your fears. Then you get married and get into the thing a little bit and get a little ways down the road, and the first thing, he's not going to church. He never intended to. He was going to church with you because that was the thing to do. And all that stuff just sort of goes down the pike. Because, look, this is how it works. This is what the trap is. The devil's never going to show you up front the consequences of a bad decision. Nor are you necessarily going to see up front all the wisdom in God's choices, which sometimes we have to obey God, even if our emotions and our thoughts are different, but on faith that God really knows what he's doing, that God's best is really the best. I read an interesting story about a forest ranger by the name of John Elliott, and he was out during a tremendous blizzard. And he was doing his job, and he was trudging through the snow. You know, that can be really laborious. He was trudging through the snow, and he was checking for avalanches, and he was checking passes. And it got towards the end of the day, and he was just exhausted. And not only that, but with all of this physical exertion, he had become damp, a bit wet. And so he realized that with this blizzard, the intensity of it increasing, he made his way to his cabin. But by the time he got to the cabin, he was just so exhausted, wet and cold, that he just collapsed and just kind of thought he'd rest for a few moments. He didn't light the stove. He didn't get a fire going. He didn't get those wet clothes off. And he lay there like that for a bit. And finally, the dog, he had a St. Bernard dog. That dog realized the problem, and that dog just started raising Cain. And that dog finally did whatever it took to get the man's attention. And later, the forest ranger said if the dog hadn't done that, he would have been dead, because, you know, this is how hypothermia works. You don't realize it. It creeps up and creeps up. And in these early stages, like when you're out there on a deer stand or something, oh, it's so cold, my teeth are chattering. Well, I hope you never get to prove what I'm going to tell you now, but you get beyond that and you get to a stage where you just kind of dull off a little bit. Like this guy, exhausted, and he just thought he'd sit down for a few minutes, and all of a sudden, he didn't really feel cold anymore. In fact, by his own testimony, he said he felt warm, felt good, not realizing what was really going on, the hypothermia. And had he gone to sleep, or had that dog not aroused him out of his lethargy and sleep, you'd die feeling good. That's the way this was, see? That's the way this was. This is something all of us need to take note of. This is how the devil operates. And you need to understand that God's wisdom is in His Word. God's ways He makes known to us. But God's not always in the business of just coming to you and saying, here's what I want you to do and here's why. Because we walk by faith many times, and God wants to show us that if we trust Him and put our hand in His hand and do what He wants us to do, that in the end, we'll worship Him and we'll say, oh, what did I avoid by following God? You know, can you look back on times in your life where you see that's true? Something you thought you had to have. Man, I can identify with my own illustration. I remember when I was a freshman in college, a girl sat right in front of me in chapel, knock your socks off. And I just thought, wow, wow, wow. And so I finally got up the nerve and sent a note. You know, that's how they did it then. I guess they still do. Finally got up a nerve and sent a note. And, you know, I was just kind of naive, I guess. And so, you know, lots of times you put a Bible verse at the end of your note. And so I put this Bible verse. It was a proverb about when a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. I just was sharing a verse I'd read and thought it was a good verse. Woo-hoo! Did I get a blisterer back from that girl? Woo, it lit the paper on fire. Oh, wow. So I kind of realized I'd been delivered after I watched for a while and saw what that deal was. But sometimes God is in the business of letting us learn these things, by experience, so that just please, I want you to get this. God's wisdom is not always readily apparent up front, nor are the consequences of making a bad choice that seems so right to us. If you're in the business of making a choice and the people that you're closest to around you and that you respect are concerned about that choice, it's time to back off and reevaluate. Well, we're going to spend only a few moments really with the last scene in this, because in the last scene, what we see, you kind of can guess what we're going to see here, but we see the bitter dregs. What happened? Well, they got what they wanted, but they lost what they had. You remember how Samuel was protesting to them in chapter 8 and said, I'm telling you, here's, God told Samuel to do this. Tell them the manner of the king. And when he was going through all of this list, I wanted to just show you this one. This is just one example, okay, from one of the verses in the interest of time. Verse 11, he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariots. And then he goes down through, he's going to take your daughters, he's going to take your sons, he's going to do all this stuff. Did that happen? It sure did. Just turn over to chapter 14, verse 52. We're just picking one of the examples. And there was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him unto him. Moms and dads, that's not really what you want, really. You want a king who, for the entire time that he's ruling and reigning, there's war. And as a result of that, there's an impressment, there's a draft, and It's one thing when you have to defend and there's an unprovoked attack or something of this nature, but it all proved true, beloved. It all proved true. Everything that God told them when he told them earlier that they would cry out, that they would be distressed. Look at verse 8 of chapter 8, verse 18. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. You see, it's too late once you married the guy. It's too late. It's too late to change that now. You've locked yourself into potentially a life of a lot of misery. What could be more tragic? We're talking about bitter dregs, and of course you know this is how it ended, but what could be more tragic than suicide? But think about it this way. In a sense, the nation experienced that suicide right along with Saul. I'm going to make a hard statement to you right now, because choosing what you want over what God makes plain is spiritual suicide. You get what you want sometimes. In fact, sometimes that's exactly how God proves to judge. We get what we want, but in the end, it's a tragedy. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Some time ago, the Daily Bread had a devotional, and it talked about this wondrous discovery that was made. I'm not sure when the discovery was made, but asbestos in its natural form is a fibrous type of a rock. And this was found to have such tremendous properties of insulating. In fact, they even made certain fabric with it in it, and it's like, wow, this is neat, it won't burn. Around 1900, 30 million tons of asbestos were used in insulation and whatnot. They didn't know at the time that it's safe as long as it does. Here's the term. I only learned this because we had to deal with it. But it's safe until it becomes what they call friable. Friable means that you break it, or in some other way it's in a tile or it's in something else and you disturb it, drill through it, bust it up, and then all of a sudden you have airborne particles of it. Harvard did a study and estimated that 500,000 people would die with asbestos sickness, asbestos-related sickness. And the thing about it is, and this is, I guess, maybe the point of using this illustration, the point about it is that sometimes it doesn't become apparent for 30 years. It's kind of like God's wisdom. You can always trust it. It'll never be wrong. But you might not see that in the beginning, but you will down the road. Folks, let me conclude by just saying this. God's best is really the best. You know, it was David. I didn't give you the verse earlier, but it really was David. Remember when he had to reject Samuel? It never was the tribe of Benjamin. It always was the tribe of Judah. But David wasn't on the scene yet. See, this is the point about not waiting for God. And so finally, when this tragedy is happening to Israel, and Samuel has to go to Saul and say, "You're done. You're done. Because the Lord has sought a man after his own heart." God's best wasn't there at that time. God's best was only a little corner, little curve, little piece of the road down further. If they had just waited. If they had just waited. And folks, you know, that's the thing. Sometimes we get so discouraged and think, "Oh, I've been waiting all this time. I'm not getting an answer to my prayer. I want this so badly." And you're tempted to compromise to have that thing. And then you find out if you'd waited another week. Because God really does hear our prayers. God's not cruel. You serve a cruel God? I don't serve any cruel God. And I've learned that if God keeps something from me, I might be upset with him in the beginning, and I might think this is a hard row to hoe. But I know in my heart, and the Bible makes it plain to me, if God makes a decision that's different than the one that I was thinking about making, it's always because he wants to do something better for me. And God always gives his best to those who leave the choices with him. I've had some amazing examples of that in my life, and I guess maybe I've seen some times to learn from the opposite. So as we begin our study on the life of Saul, I come back to my opening question. Do you desire God's best? Do you? Because God's best really is the best. And God always gives his best to those who leave the choices with him. Father, encourage us. It's so difficult sometimes to wait on you, to see your wisdom. Sometimes we feel like we're on hold. Not many people really like to be on hold. Sometimes we have pent-up desire, and the thing that we want is not necessarily wrong. It's just that your answer to that prayer isn't quite ready yet. Or, if it's no, it's because you have something better, and you know the other thing is not good for us. Help us, Lord, when we realize that you love us too much ever to be unkind. You're too wise ever to make a mistake. Help us to settle that in our hearts today and give you those matters of our heart and those matters and decisions of our lives so that we may have God's best. And we pray for grace. In Jesus' wonderful name, amen.